Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Jason Fung. He's author of The Obesity Code, Unlocking the Secrets of Weight Loss. In part one, he's explained to us why we seem to be stymied in our efforts to lose weight and why rates of obesity, diabetes are skyrocketing in spite of our best efforts. Our low-fat diet approach has been tremendously unsuccessful. But in the book, Dr. Fung, you also talk about the Atkins diet, and you start off by saying, you know, good idea, because they kind of turn the paradigm on its head. It's a low-carb diet, which is good, but something went wrong with the Atkins diet in terms of the ratios of the macronutrients.
Yeah, and it's not simply just the ratios of the macronutrients, but it was kind of combined with a low-fat kind of craze. So things got turned into a very high-protein diet rather than kind of a high-fat diet, because nobody wanted to say that they were a high-fat diet. Remember, this is in the mid-90s when we were in the midst of this entire low-fat kind of mania.
So was it like all about like lean meat, lean meat, lean meat, and maybe
exactly.
That didn't work?
It didn't really work. It had the right idea because a lot of the carbohydrates were very stimulating to insulin. So if you understand that obesity is a disease of too much insulin, then you can say, well, how are we going to lower that insulin? Well, one, some of the foods that raise insulin the most are the refined grains and the sugar, so we should cut those down. So Atkins had that part absolutely right. It worked for a lot of people, for sure. But when you start going into high-protein diets, the problem is that protein can also stimulate insulin to almost as high a degree, depending on what protein you're talking about.
That's interesting. So I think a lot of people don't know that. There's something that we learned about, back in college and in med school. It's gluconeogenesis, which maybe you can explain. You can actually get sugar from protein, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you eat protein, what happens is that you break it down into its amino acids. So your body absorbs those amino acids, and they're the building blocks of new protein. So when you're turning over your protein or building new protein, then you're going to use some of that amino acid. But if you have too much of it, your body can't store it the same way it can store sugar and can store fat. So in essence, what happens is that those amino acids get brought to the liver, and the liver turns that into sugar. So eating a very high protein diet doesn't wind up getting you around the fact that you're just putting a lot of sugar into your body. So if you eat normal amounts of protein, then you're just going to use that amount to build protein or turn over protein, but excessive amounts were not good. So, in essence, if you look back at the original Atkins diets, they were very high in fat.
Yeah, I knew Dr. Atkins, and he was very much a partisan of, lots of high-fat cheese and, you know, fatty meats,
yeah.
Bacon cheeseburgers,
yeah.
Throw away the bun. But, maybe it got lost in translation.
It got lost a little bit in translation in the kind of reboot in the mid-90s to 2000s. I mean, there was a lot of good things that came out of that, this focus on sugars, for example, so sodas and so on, sugary cereals. If you look, they've been kind of trending downward since the early 2000s. And I think that was a lot in response to a lot of the attention that the Atkins diet sort of brought. And a lot of these low-carbohydrate diets that kind of followed along, they kind of went the same way. And it was thought that, well, we're kind of on the cusp of breaking this entire obesity crisis, but unfortunately, again, it really only addressed one part of the problem, which is the dietary part and not the entire picture of the insulin and insulin resistance. And that's where it and a lot of the diets really kind of fall down, because they don't really talk about that so much. So the insulin resistance cycle is independent of the diet, and that's the thing that you really have to focus on to get long-term success. Most dietary studies, dieters know this very well. You do very well for about 6 months, and then the regain kind of starts, and that's your body kind of kicking in that body set weight.
So let's get to your 5-point program. There are five main points to your way of kind of flipping the switch on this insulin resistance.
Yeah, so the first four are fairly obvious. It follows from this sort of insulin, so you want to cut your sugars. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The second is really to cut out the refined carbohydrates, so things like the breads and the pastas, the muffins, donuts and waffles and so on. All those very starchy foods, they stimulate insulin a lot. So if they do, you should really cut it down. The third point is to kind of moderate protein and not go super crazy on eating very high protein diets, especially not these protein shakes and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
While some people have had some success with it, it generally isn't real food, and you should really stick to unprocessed foods rather than kind of processed whey protein kind of thing.
Thank you for saying that, because I think there are a lot of these programs where they say, well, you know, here you get all the protein you need and without the fat and without the carbohydrates. So that's the building block for your body. Your body will be sustained and there won't be very few calories. But those don't really work. They don't really produce as much satiety as sitting down to a real meal that has fiber and flavor and doesn't get chugged, basically, because it goes right down your alimentary tract, really, and it's a quick hit and it's gone.
Yeah, and the thing is that you don't never know with these processed things what you're actually, like, what's the long-term effect. People haven't been using these meal replacements for very long, but you've been eating real food for, you know, as long as you've been humans, right? So clearly, if you're going to go with one, the best thing is to go with real food, right?
Indeed.
So stick to moderate protein. And then the fourth thing, which is a little bit counterintuitive, is to eat lots of natural fats. So that's the thing that we talked about earlier, which is that dietary fat, despite the fact that it has a lot of calories, doesn't stimulate insulin a lot. So eat more of these natural fats.
So when you say that, when you say this about, you know, advocating fat, a lot of people can say, okay, sure, fine. You know, I'll have plenty of olive oil. I'll eat avocados. I'll eat some nuts. But surely, Dr. Fung, you don't mean fat from high-fat dairy products, from marbled steak, the skin of poultry. Those are the, quote, bad fats, right?
Well, in fact, the evidence to support this kind of idea that saturated fats are bad for the heart is not really very strong at all. In fact, people have been starting to go back on that. So the idea originally was that the saturated fat was going to clog up your arteries kind of thing. The problem was a lot of the original data kind of confused trans fats, which are very bad, and saturated fats, natural saturated fats, which are a lot of those animal fats, coconut oil, that kind of thing, that are actually found in nature. And it seems very strange. It's almost this fatal conceit that we have as humans, that we're smarter than Mother Nature. So even though humans have been eating saturated fat for millennia, again, as long as we've been humans, we've been eating natural saturated fat, whether it was from coconut oil, from coconuts, or whether it was from meat, we've been eating saturated fat. So the idea that this is actually going to kill us is very, very wrong. It's like almost like we're so smart as humans that we make our own rules and Mother Nature doesn't apply. It's kind of like this whole breast milk thing. We can make a better breast milk than breast milk, right? And then in the 70s, we really thought that, right? We really thought that we could actually do that, but it's actually not true at all. So now in the last 10 years or so it's interesting following this entire fat debate that what originally happened was that these monounsaturated fats, such as olive oil and nuts and so on, started coming back. So the Mediterranean diet was coming more in vogue. So in the 90s, 80s and 90s, all fats were bad, right? Everything was bad. People would like be aghast if you're eating avocados. They're like, oh my God, you know that avocado is just full of fat. And now it's like a superfood, right? Same as olive oil, right? It's like, oh my God, you can't be eating all that olive oil. You can't just drizzle it on your salad, right?
Exactly.
And everybody's like, yeah, you should drizzle more on, right? Because it's a great food. And it's true. And the thing is that now we're talking about healthy fats, and now the tide is also turning against these kind of natural saturated fats. And what you really want to stay away from are these kind of processed man-made fats, such as canola oil and corn oil, fats that are really processed rather than existing in nature.
Not just trans fats, but fats that are high in omega-6, which are pro-inflammatory for the body.
Yeah, all the sunflower oils and so on, because you wind up processing literally tons and tons of corn, because corn is not oily, to get corn oil or any of these other things. So really what you want to eat are like foods that are minimally processed. So if you take olive oil, you take olives, squish them, and you get oil, right? That's
pretty oily.
That's what extra virgin olive oil is, right? There's no chemicals. There's no anything.
You're not very fond of the animal research, which, you know, decades ago demonstrated that taking in a lot of saturated fats. I mean, I think Nechkow was a Russian physiologist who fed rabbits lard, and very rapidly they developed atherosclerosis. So, ergo, that's the artery clogging substance that gives Americans heart disease. But there's a problem in translating that animal research to humans.
Well, exactly, and the fact is that rabbits are herbivores, so they really
right.
should be eating cholesterol and all that sort of thing. And the thing is that this entire idea that fat is what clogs your arteries is very wrong. And we've known this, again, for at least 30 years. So atherosclerosis, which is the process of blocking the arteries, is not simply a matter of too much fat in our blood or too much cholesterol in the blood. And we've known this for a long time. It's really a response to injury. So something is actually injuring the lining of the blood vessel wall, and that's what allows all these fats and inflammatory cells and smooth muscle proliferation that eventually narrows the artery and clogs it up. So it's actually some kind of response to injury. It's not just the excessive dietary fats or dietary cholesterol. That really doesn't have very much bearing at all to what happens. And so if you look at what happens now, people have gone back and looked at all the data going back decades. Dr. Zoe Harcombe did it recently in the BMJ. She looked at all the evidence in the 1970s and early 80s and realized that there really is no evidence to support any of these guidelines, either on total fat or saturated fat. Dr. Roland Krauss, who's a cardiologist, also did a huge meta-analysis looking again at saturated fat and found there actually is no evidence to say that eating these saturated fats are bad for us. So that's where the tide is kind of turning. And in the last dietary guidelines in 2015, they still kept the saturated fat warning in there, but the warning about total fats got removed. Again, getting back to this idea that, you know what, we're kind of wrong about this whole fat making you fat idea. It just wasn't correct.
They're making some changes, but not quite enough. So you kind of push back against some of the traditional rules of dieting. One of the traditional mantras for people trying to lose weight is eat frequent small meals to stave off hunger cravings. That's defensive eating.
Yeah,
good idea or bad
idea?
Yeah,
that's a very bad idea because, again, it's something that has not been done for a long time. I'm not a fan of the sort of latest and greatest. I'm sort of, I like to look at things that are tried and tested and have withstood the test of time. And we simply didn't eat 6 or 7 or 8 times a day, right? Who has time for that, right? And lots of people over history have eaten once or twice a day, for example, because it's a lot easier, right? You don't have to cook and clean and do all this. And it's a lot simpler if you can eat sort of just a few times a day rather than spending your entire day thinking about what you're going to eat constantly. And the thing is that if you stimulate insulin constantly, it's just going to lead to more resistance, which is going to lead to more obesity in the long term. And that's one of the problems. So everybody thinks that, oh, well, you should eat small, frequent meals. But if you look and try to go back and say, where did this advice come from? I'm not even sure where it came from. Somebody just made it up and thought it was a good idea.
Right.
I think it got pushed a lot by snack food companies, truthfully.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was all advertising.
And another one of the tried and true diet piece of advice is have a big breakfast. Get up and have a hearty breakfast because that'll set the stage for later in the day. It'll have plenty of protein so that later in the day you don't you crave sugar. So
yeah.
You have a little bit of pushback against that notion.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's anything that is special about breakfast. So if you eat a big breakfast, it's fine. But the issue is that you don't want to eat a lot of high-carbohydrate foods, which is the problem at breakfast time. So if
that's
you think
the carbiest, the carbiest meal, because it's, you know, pancakes or toast or orange juice.
Yeah.
And cereal, cold cereal, which is kind of an aberration historically. It was sort of invented in the 1890s by C.W. Post and Harvey Kellogg as a way of marketing grains to Americans.
Yeah, and the thing is that the other thing is that if you look at studies of circadian rhythms, the hunger is lowest at 8 o'clock in the morning, right? And that's why most of the kids are not hungry, because there will never be a point where you have less hunger than at that point. That's our natural circadian rhythm. So stuffing your face when you're not hungry is not likely to be a very good strategy for weight loss in the future. So the thing about breakfast that's interesting is that the word itself gives you the clue. It's the meal that breaks your fast, which means that you have to be fasting every day. You simply cannot be stuffing your face like from the minute you go to bed, and then as soon as you get up, stuffing your face again. You have not given your body a chance to fast. But that's part of everyday life. You have, in order to break the fast, you have to be fasting, right? And there's nothing wrong with giving yourself a little bit of extra time and breaking your fast at 12 o'clock with salmon or chicken or whatever it is, rather than two slices of toast with jam and orange juice, which is pure refined carbohydrates, right? So the thing about breakfast is that it tends to be the rushed, right? Everybody's going to work, it's going to school, you got teams, and you got this, and you got that, you got a big meeting. So we want convenience, which turns out to be carbs, right?
Because a Pop-Tart.
So much easier.
Pop it in the toaster.
Pop-Tart rather than two eggs.
Yep.
Now, if you like to have two eggs, fine, go ahead. But people just don't do that anymore, right? It's just so rushed, it's so difficult for people to do, so that's why they don't do it. So it's not that there's anything intrinsically wrong, but one, you have to give your body a chance to fast, first of all, and two, what happens is that if you fast, the only thing that happens is your body pulls some of that food energy you've stored away from last night's dinner or yesterday's lunch and burns it for energy, right? That's all that happens, and it's natural, and there's nothing wrong with that. So instead of forcing food into your mouth when you're not hungry, let your body burn off some of the food that it ate last night until lunchtime, right? That's all you're doing. You're giving your body a chance, a little bit longer, to burn off some of this excess fat and sugar that you've stored away.
What about actual fasting?
Everybody thinks there's something really, really bad about it, but it's like, what's wrong with that?
Right. What about actual fasting? Because you seem to be an advocate of IF, intermittent fasting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a strategy that gives people options. Because the thing is that fasting is not something to do, it's something to not do, right? So say you skip a couple of meals, say you skip breakfast, or say you skip breakfast and lunch. All you're doing is giving your body a chance to burn some of that energy. It's essentially the flip side of eating, right? If you're not eating, you're fasting. That's it. And what you want to do is put that in balance, right? So eating and fasting have to be in balance. When you're always eating, you're going to gain weight. If you're balanced fasting and eating, you're not going to gain or lose weight. But if you want to lose weight, you need to do more fasting than eating. And that's essentially the idea. So you're going to give your body a chance to burn down some of this energy. And there's so many myths that have kind of grown up around skipping meals. Say you skip two meals, breakfast and lunch. So you're doing a 24-hour fast, right? So what happens is that your body just burns some of the excess energy. You don't go into this kind of starvation mode or burn protein or whatever. You know, people talk about burning protein, but the truth is that the body burns off this excess amino acids to start with, right? Most of us eat more protein than we actually use. So instead of turning that amino acids into glucose that gets turned into fat, you just burn some of it off. But you're not burning muscle, right? And the other thing is this starvation mode is the idea that your body is going to shut down, that is, reduce its caloric expenditure so much that you're going to make it easy to gain weight. And this is super ironic, because that's exactly what happens when you simply cut calories. Right? Mm-hmm. We talked earlier that when you simply cut calories, your body actually cuts its caloric expenditure, which means it's going into starvation mode. But when you fast, your body actually does not. So if you measure fasting at the beginning of a four-day fast and the end of a four-day fast, the resting metabolic rate, which is how much energy you're burning, is not lower at the fourth day. It's higher.
Wow.
It's like 14% higher than it was when you started.
Okay.
Because your body has now switched fuel sources from food to stored food. And since there's lots of fat, which is all that stored food is, it keeps burning it at a high rate. So instead of saying, oh, you know, everything's kind of coming down, you keep burning it at that steady rate, which is exactly what you wanted to do. There's no metabolic slowdown, which is what you get with caloric reduction. And that's the ironic part, is that where all these kind of nutritional authorities say, oh, you should just cut 500 calories a day, right, and you'll lose a pound a week. You will definitely not lose it, because we've all done it. We've done lots of studies on it. And the failure rate of this kind of cutting a few calories a day is roughly 99%. That's roughly the success rate is 1% in the studies that we've done, right? So the funny part is that if we advise people to follow this kind of portion control, reduce your calories a bit every day, it's guaranteed to fail. And then when those people fail, we blame them for it and say,
right,
oh, you just couldn't stick to your diet. It's like, well, the advice...
Which is very disempowering and discouraging. And, you know, I think the whole diet industry, I think, is an industry which is both impoverished a lot of Americans, but also disempowered a lot of Americans, because, you know, you keep going back to the slot machine and it never yields the jackpot that you're looking for.
Right. And so, then they say it's your fault, right? That's
exactly
the problem.
Exactly. So, incidentally, in the book, you actually talk about the benefits of vinegar. And that's an interesting comment from a professional nephrologist, because that's kind of a folk remedy. Why do you say vinegar might be a useful accoutrement to a weight loss diet?
Yeah. So, again, if you go back to the entire idea that insulin is really what drives weight gain, then there are actually protective factors that lower insulin. The main one really being fiber. So fiber really reduces those kind of insulin spikes, and so does vinegar. And vinegar is one of the most traditional folk remedies for weight loss, actually. People take a little vinegar and water and chug it down.
Mm-hmm.
And they
apple cider vinegar, that kind of thing, that remedy.
Absolutely. Yeah, and also for type 2 diabetes, it's the same idea. And also a lot of these fermented foods, so for vinegar is acetic acid, but a lot of these fermented foods are lactic acids, so sourdough breads and these other things, such as, you know, vinegar and olive oil, right, which is, again, a very traditional kind of thing. Fermented foods like kimchi and natto and other things that people have eaten. And you almost think sometimes that sauerkraut, for example, is like, why would they eat that in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how did they figure out that that was actually really good for you? Which I always think is fascinating, because even back then, you know, these foods like, say, sauerkraut, which are a little bit sour and, you know, you wouldn't immediately think is the best thing for you, eventually become traditional parts of the diet, because people realize that, yes, there's a lot of kind of power here.
Interesting. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? There's lots more details, of course, in the book with some very, very well-done explanations of how metabolism works and what you can do to turn things around. What are some of the resources in addition to your book that are available? Do you have a website?
Yeah, we have a website called intensivedietarymanagement.com. So there's lots about... I write a weekly blog, and it talks a lot about type 2 diabetes, and there's a lot of good information there, and there's the book, and also soon there will be some other things. So we have a program called the Intensive Dietary Management Program, which is geared towards obesity and type 2 diabetes, which is really focused on working with them through the diet rather than medications, because the last thing people want to do is take medications, yet when you go to the doctor, about the only thing he tells you to do is take medications, right? And so there's a real gap there between what people actually want to do, which is try and treat it naturally, and people are willing to put some effort into it, because none of this is easy, right? I tell them, it's not the easy dietary management program, right? I'm not selling you some snake oil, take this and everything will be fine. I'm saying there's a lot of work here to be done, and we're willing to help you do it, but it's all on you, right? So it's intensive, but people are willing to do it. So there's recipes. You can also go to www.dietdoctor.com, which is an excellent website for low carbohydrate, high fat diets, and also a lot about intermittent fasting, because fasting is something that most people haven't tried, and it doesn't mean you fast for 40 days and 40 nights, right? It might mean just fasting for 16 hours at a time, which is, say, not eating until noon, and that's something people used to do. You know, they'd have a cup of coffee for breakfast, and then that's it, right? So they kind of inadvertently did it. And nobody died, right? It's not like, oh, right. You know, when my dad just had a cup of coffee for breakfast, oh, look how unhealthy he was. You know, nothing happened to them. There was nothing wrong with it. And there's a lot of recipes at dietdoctor.com. The intermittent fasting it talks about. And so those are some of the resources that they can go to. You know, all those are free.
Incidentally, you're not the biggest fan of exercise for weight loss. You talk about the exercise myth, right?
Yeah. The exercise is very healthy for you, but in terms of power to make you lose weight, it, again, falls into that whole calories paradigm, which is that it's really a method to burn off calories. But since calories is not the main driver of obesity, it's not that effective. What you really need to do is lower insulin. And exercise has a small effect, definitely, but it's not a big one, and that's the whole problem. So it's healthy for you, for sure. It builds muscle tone, it's a form of stress release. There's all kinds of benefits to exercise, but the problem is that it's not that effective for weight loss. And we've pretended for so many years that diet and exercise are like 50-50 partners, right? And they're not really. Diet is like 95% of the battle.
Yeah, it's like
exercise is like 5%.
It's like drink that Gatorade and then work it off with a 5-mile run.
Exactly.
It doesn't necessarily work that way.
Exactly, and that's where the kind of dialogue got pushed by a lot of the soft drink companies and Gatorade and snack food companies that, yes, you could drink that Gatorade and you'll exercise and you won't gain weight. But the problem is that you drink that Gatorade, your insulin spikes way up, you do the exercise, that insulin only goes down a tiny little bit. Right, and the analogy I sometimes use is that it's not that exercise is not important, but it's like if you play baseball and you think that bunting is an important part of the game, that's fine, but it's not 50% of the game.
Right.
So you're not going to spend 50% of your time practicing your bunting. It's all about pitching, defense, and hitting, right? And maybe 5% is bunting. Mm-hmm. So you spend a little bit of time on it, and that's the same with exercise. If you want to lose weight, then you need to think 95% of the time on diet and spend like a little bit of time on exercise. If you want to get healthy, for example, and you want to build muscle and you want to, you know, look good in terms of having a six-pack and all that, yeah, you need to exercise, right? You can't diet yourself to
right.
that kind of muscle
right.
gain, right. right? You need to exercise, right? And that's the exact other thing, right? But don't confuse the two. But they get confused in this whole calorie paradigm. And I think it's because the food companies and drink companies really like that idea that it's all about calories, because all of a sudden, it's not the sugar that's making you fat, it's the calories that are making you fat. And the calories might come from broccoli. They're still making you fat, right? That's
yeah.
what they want you to believe.
Yeah.
But you've got to be crazy to believe that drinking 100 calories of soda is the same as eating 100 calories of broccoli. I'll tell you for sure that they're not the same as soon as they go in your mouth, because the soda spikes your insulin and the broccoli does not.
Well, we could go on and on, because there's a fascinating discussion in the book, The Obesity Code, Unlocking the Secrets of Weight Loss. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jason Fung, for joining us once again. The website is, please repeat.
It's www.intensivedietarymanagement.com.
Thanks again for being with us, and congratulations on your new book. I hope it gets out to lots of people. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.